Thanks, Carl. Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, Minister Michael Healy raised Storm Mayo and progress reports. Listening to the wind through the larches in Clare, jumping through hoops in Tip, big day out for Ag Science students in Offaly, and beef at never-seen-before prices. I don't know if you were up in time to see it this morning, but at least here on the East Coast, my God, your bank holiday began with the most glorious sunrise you've ever seen. A very pointed contrast as well to this day 50 days ago. It's 50 days today since Storm Éowyn. 50 days since the horticulture and the forestry sectors were given an unprecedented thumping. Both are in the brief of Junior Minister Michael Healy Ray, and on the programme that week he promised that no effort would be spared. He had just started, the storm had just happened, so it wasn't the right time for a detailed scrutiny of what had and hadn't been done by his department. Today is, though, and I am happy to say he has joined us again. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning to you and to all your listeners, and thanks for the opportunity of giving a progress report on where exactly we are in these very two important sectors.
I'd say you were blinded by that sunrise on the road from Kilgarvan to the Radio de Gaeltachta studios in Ballyverna this morning.
Well, you see, you were talking about the East Coast there, but if you were here with Padraig O'Riordan, as I am, and, you know, I was hoping he might actually sing a song for me this morning, because that would raise the cockles of your heart. But this is definitely the nicest part of the world to be in today. So anybody that's in the East Coast, I'd actually suggest that they should head for Kerry right away, and indeed parts of West Cork as well.
Well, you just sit there, sit tight, and feel satisfied that you are in the part of the world that you're in while you listen to an interview that I recorded with somebody in the forestry sector earlier on this week. All of the trees knocked down by Storm Éowyn would fill the Phoenix Park 34 times over. And those who already have a thinning or a felling licence can get on with harvesting their windblown trees. Those that don't, though, have to wait now while a notoriously slow bureaucratic process is gone through. Meanwhile, those trees in contact with the ground will begin to rot. Noel Kelly has 150 acres of a mixed plantation outside Broadford in East Clare. The broadleaves and the pines were left mostly undisturbed by the storm, but up to 70% of the Sitka spruce were blown over. And Noel is unclear now on how much, if any, help he is going to get in replanting. You can hear how even on a calm day like today, the tops of these trees are catching the wind.
Yeah.
It must have been fearsome here on the night of the storm.
A friend of ours who lives in the locality was saying there's an old man lives 200, 300 yards just beyond it, and at 3:30 in the morning he could hear all this banging going on outside, hadn't a clue what it was, and he plucked up the courage to go out and investigate with a torch. It was another man's plantation. The trees were just snapping. Bang, bang, bang.
Wow.
It had to be fairly intense.
Breaking them in two.
Yeah, and that's a 30-year-old plantation, I suspect. It's older than ours, anyway.
They're young and shaky, a lot of your trees. If you were comparing them to an animal, it would be kind of a newborn calf wobbling to get
yes.
on its legs, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Basically, broad terms, 25% Sitka spruce, 25% hybrid larch, just 25% other conifers, Scots pine.
Scots pine, Corsican pine, Douglas fir. It's really, really diverse.
It is, and Western red cedar, even.
Yeah, and we've just passed a cherry tree, and I see willow, and I see hazel, and I see beech.
Californian redwood, giant redwood.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Just random stuff as well, just to enhance it. And then the other 25% in is broad leaves, ash, oak, and a bit of beech.
And what's interesting is they all seem, by and large, completely unaffected.
Pretty much. There are branches and the odd one down, but it's the Sitka board brunt of it. So the master plan would be get the felling license, go off then and see about who, a contractor to come in and harvest.
How long do you think it's going to take you to get a felling license? What have been your experience on getting the thinning licenses?
The license for the ash dieback took nearly 3 years.
Okay. Oh, wow. What am I looking at here? Is that about 5-6 acres?
Yeah.
Just absolutely flattened?
Yeah. Do you think you're looking at total devastation? But actually, they're only knocked over sideways. They're still intact. And if they're not left too long, it's still a salvageable crop timber.
I'm no expert, Noel, but these all look so young that they're not going to make saw logs, that you're probably just looking at pulp, are you?
Pulp and pellet wood, I suspect, is what I'm looking at.
Okay. And what kind of price are you going to get for that? Are you going to cover your costs?
No. That's the issue. We won't.
How much out of pocket do you think you're going to be?
Well, sure, those figures suggest anything up to 3,000 a hectare.
What does that do to your confidence in forestry?
After Storm Darwin, they brought in kind of replanting support for the lads that were affected. And we'll say there's a blueprint there now from the ash dieback.
I suppose in some respects, what's important here is, yes, you and that you're looked after and you're helped, but that the people sitting on the sidelines right now and thinking, do I or do I not get into forestry, would probably be saying, well, look at what happened to Noel Kelly.
And if you think that we're down around 2,000 hectares being planted every year and they want 8,000 plus, like, this isn't going to encourage anyone. But in the other side, the coin, if you wanted to be optimistic about it, if they kind of grasp the nettle now and kind of look after the Noel Kellys of the country, then that'll give lads encouragement, maybe, that they won't be left stranded. It's kind of, in many ways, a watershed for the state as well as ourselves.
Noel Kelly and his plantation outside Broadford. So, Minister, can we break this down, I think, into three different areas? What are you going to be able to do to speed up the licensing? What are you going to be able to do to support them with the harvesting costs? What are you going to be able to do to support them with the replanting costs?
Okay. Well, first of all, what Noel Kelly said there, and I understand, because I've been into many forestries now around the country that have been blown and have been split. So I can only imagine the hurt and the worry and the concern that the Noel Kellys of the world have. But first of all, he is factually correct when he said his previous experience of applying for licenses would have been actually a nightmare. He's not incorrect when he said it was years to get a license, but that was the system and that was what happened at that time. My attitude about problems, I don't look at either politically or any other reason why things were wrong in the past, but I can assure Noel Kelly and every other Noel Kelly, people who don't have a license, their applications will be dealt with in a speedy and prompt fashion. And I'm giving you that assurance. That is what is happening as applications are coming in.
Give him a timeline, Minister. Give him a date.
I will, absolutely. We envisage that any application that will come in now will be turned around within a matter of months. Now, if you want me to be specific, it could be 3 months, it could be 4 months. But that's the type of time frame.
But under 6 months.
But under 6 months. But the one thing that I want to say to you, which a pile of people, and I'd really appreciate the opportunity of getting this message out there. You know there's a massive amount of timber on the ground. There's 24,000 hectares of timber on the ground. But our analysis shows us that at least 50 to 60% of that timber has actually got a license. Because as you know, I did as I promised you 50 days ago, I changed the rules with regard to licensing. So if you had a thinning license, that actually now can automatically become a clear fell license.
Indeed, but the unlicensed timber still accounts for 3 or 4 times more than you've ever had to cope with after a storm. So is the system going to be able to cope? And can you make an absolute promise that all those licenses are going to be issued within 3 or 4 months?
I can give you an absolute assurance that they'll be issued on time. And what I mean by that, you do understand, we have only so many forwarders, we've only so many harvesters, we've only so many lorries with a trailer in this country, we've only so much capacity in our sawmills. Now, if you take 50 or 60% of 24,000, my point is, there's an awful lot of work to get on with in Ireland at the moment without any licence. So while that work is proceeding and keeping everybody extremely busy, then you have time then to have those licenses going in and being processed. Where we would have an awful problem, if we were looking at 24,000 hectares of timber on the ground and if it had no license whatsoever. I was at a meeting the other night in Kilkenny, and there was forestry owners at that meeting. And a question was asked by one of the organisers, how many people in this room have a license? And that's the way we're worded now, because thinning or felling license makes no difference. So how many people had a license? And virtually everyone in the room put up their hands. Now, I know that's not a scientific study, but our facts are between 50 and 60% of 24,000 hectares as a license.
Okay.
So it's not as though there isn't enough work to get on with.
Let's talk about the replanting here.
Yes.
It's the Sitka spruce which seems to have been particularly badly affected. Sitka spruce monoculture, as you know, is very controversial. Is this a good time to look at replanting with something else, or at least a mix? Because there could be another storm, Eowyn, within another 10 years that's going to do exactly the same kind of damage again to that particular tree.
There could, but one thing I want to say in answering that, because Noel Kelly touched on this, he made a very important point. He said Hawaii and other people like me are going to be dealt with will determine the future of forestry in Ireland. And he's actually correct. If this event is supported adequately politically by myself, by the officials in my department, and if we are seen to be with the people who gave their land to forestry many years ago, and if we are seen to support them, that is why a reconstitution grant of some sort is so important, or a support to be put in place. Because if you're a forestry...
So is that a promise, Minister? Can they take that to the bank? There will be support for replanting.
What I'm telling you is I'm sitting down very regularly with the officials in the department. We only have the full analysis of the amount of ground we're talking about. We're trying to put a costing on this as to what it will actually cost. And the only assurance I can give you is there will be a scheme of some sort. I will obviously be trying to make that as much as is possible to support as many people as possible. And I wouldn't be drawing it down to you, or I wouldn't be discussing it with you, unless I believe in it, I'm committed to it, and I want it to happen. Because again, coming back to Noel Kelly and his very polite question, depending on how I'm treated and people like me, that'll determine how many people in the future will plant forests.
All right, so there will be some kind of support. It remains to be seen how much it is that you're able to afford. That's fair enough. I want to turn our attention, if we can, to horticulture, please, because obviously Eowyn directed a huge amount of its fury at polytunnels. And unless now those are replaced in short order, the window for propagating seedlings for this summer's crop of salad leaves and veg is going to end up being missed. So during the week, I visited Conor Foxton of Redwood Market Garden in Lura, North Tipperary, who lost a third of his tunnel space to Storm Eowyn. The sounds of spring cut in two by a consaw. Conor felt that he was unable to begin removing the wreckage of his polytunnel until Monday. 45 days after the storm hit, because he needed proof it had been destroyed.
we were waiting on some supports, government supports for growers that suffered damage, and it was kind of a limbo period. We didn't know what was coming, if there was going to be supports and what form they would take, and whether you would have to prove you had that you lost the tunnel.
Little bit frustrating that you had to wait until now to just start removing the wreckage.
I had a lot going on with trying to deal with the department.
Has that been easy?
It's tough. It's, as I sort of said, it's kind of like the limbo period.
It's also the start of the growing period, the propagation period, isn't it?
Yeah, so this tunnel here, I should have had sown potatoes 2 weeks ago. Potatoes for early harvest for, you know, premium price at the market, early season, June bank holiday, and early crop of carrots. And those potatoes and carrots would be the first of the season, and they would take me all the way through to now.
And you've missed that window, have you, completely?
So I got a little bit in another tunnel, small tunnel, not enough to cater for demand, but I got something anyway. So
that could be done again.
As we're talking, the postman arrives.
This is Bertie, just Philip.
Bertie, how are you doing?
How are you going? Going well.
Is that a significant piece of post then?
It's a planning exemption from the county council to replace a tunnel that was already existing. So it's the Department of Agriculture requirement that I get either planning for it or an exemption.
Even though it was already there and you're just going to replace it with something that would be exactly the same?
Exact same footprint.
You still have to go through this exercise?
Luckily, I can get an exemption, but some people can't do it.
Yeah, but can you claim back the expenses now of all that back again?
No. Well, look, it was €80, like, but still it was time as well.
I know, yeah, but you fill in forms and all that.
When did you apply?
Received on 19th of February, referred to your application, received on 19th. So I drove into the council with the thing and
Fairness, it is a pretty swift response.
It is.
I mean, it's 2.5 weeks, but still, it does seem like a bit of cumbersome bureaucracy to ask permission to replace something with exactly what was there before.
Yeah,
if you want to make it longer now or wider or something, putting back up a new one, yeah, you'd say something. But it's the exact same footprint.
It doesn't matter anymore. They just put a blanket requirement out there, and so
I don't know. They don't bureaucrat and all like that. It's, you can't do nothing on them now. Hush stuff.
Yeah.
Eowyn didn't just rip up the polytunnel. It lifted the concrete moorings for the metal frame clean out of the ground. They must all be removed now.
You're going to need a bigger hammer.
I got a quote for supply and construction from a local polytunnel company. They said they could do it in July at the earliest. If I ordered then, that was back in February when I made the inquiry.
Were you a bit hesitant about making a firm booking with them before knowing whether the state was going to be able to help you or not?
Yeah, well, I couldn't, because this terms and conditions of the scheme that the government have reopened state that you cannot make a booking, make any payment, until you get approved from the Department of Agriculture.
So you can't even, technically speaking, have made that phone call to the polytunnel company until the Department of Agriculture has given you the thumbs up?
No, I can make the phone call and I can inquire and get a quotation. I need a quotation for the scheme.
But you can't make a booking?
I can't make a booking, no. So, but the important thing there is that they won't put me in their order book until I make a booking, i.e. pay 20% deposit.
They can't even pencil you in until you get the green light from the department?
Exactly.
And how is that going?
So I've made an application to the scheme, and that was submitted last Friday. I asked in my cover letter if I could get a time frame on when they will have approvals. I have been unsuccessful so far in finding that out.
Those sounds of spring, so welcomed by everyone else, are like a ticking clock for Connor. He needs to have a replacement tunnel up and running by May 1st, somewhere to sow all of the seeds that he has just started propagating.
It could be a case, if I don't get it up before the 1st of May, that's it. At the latest, those plants will be composted. There won't be a place for them. So it's a big hit. It'll be a massive hit to growers' incomes if they can't get their summer crops in.
Where are you, do you think? Are you on the brink of something that risks the entire enterprise, or is this just going to be a really phenomenally bad year?
Look, I'm going to continue regardless. I'll continue until it's not possible. So and I know of growers in the same position, they'll... Okay, everyone's in a different position, I suppose, but there's resilience there. They have customers, they have demand. Like, it's just crazy that you have an existing business and you're looking for aid from the government. You have to put all these roadblocks in your way and even asking for all business plans. And that's fine, we put in our business plans. But, I mean, the demand is there. Like, it's not as if we're looking for an investment and then in the hope that we'll get sales out of it. We have the sales. Like, the demand is there, the customers are there, so the income is there.
Sales which could conceivably end up being met this summer by produce grown abroad.
Exactly, yeah.
Conor Foxton in Lura in Tipperary there. Minister Michael Healy-Ray is still with us. Minister, what's with all the bureaucracy?
Well, first of all, when I hear Conor Foxton's analysis of what has happened, you have to look at the facts, because at the end of the day, I'm charged with the responsibility of trying to help people like Conor. He absolutely knows in his heart and soul that that's exactly what I want to do. That is why immediately at the first opportunity, I brought together the different people from the different sectors of the growing industry in Ireland under the Horticultural Industry Forum. I co-chaired the very first meeting with Orla McManus, and then immediately after that, literally on the, I think it was the 14th of February, I introduced a scheme whereby people could apply for and get support to take them back to where they were.
Okay, that's but well the problem there, Minister, was that you, rather than designing a scheme to help growers replace storm-damaged tunnels, you reopened an old scheme that was designed to help people starting off in business. Hence all of these requirements for planning exemptions and business plans and so on. Was that a bit lazy of you not to come up with a specially designed scheme?
No, we had to. The quickest scheme that we could open was the actual model of the scheme that was there before. Now, having visited in the meantime places that had this type of damage, I quickly realised that the quickest way that they could actually replace what they had was by going under the terms and conditions of the old scheme. And Conor himself said, yes, of course, when you need an exemption from planning. To be fair, his local county council, they did issue him with an exemption.
I know, but it added 3 weeks to the process. You know, so whatever time you might have gained by putting that scheme in place straight away has been lost with all of this paperwork.
When you are administering a scheme and giving people money, whether we like it or not, you have to account for what you're doing. There has to be rules. There has to be regulations. From the point of view of a person who's already, after having a loss, suffering damage, the last thing they want to be doing is filling up forms and doing paperwork. And I heard the man there that was with Conor, and he was saying this whole thing is too bureaucratic. Sure, of course that man is right, but every day of the week, when you're involved in farming, when you're involved in different schemes, everything is bureaucratic. And I hate that there's so much red tape, and I don't like it. But
and it's important that there is, because it's public money.
But at the same time,
Minister, I mean, making somebody apply for planning permission on something that has been knocked down and is going to be replaced with something of exactly the same size and dimensions, that's real self-licking ice cream cone territory, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to just tell you another fact in case you don't know it. Do you realise that the house that you're living in yourself, if you wanted to replace the roof on that tomorrow morning, not the slate, but if you wanted to replace the timber and the slate on that roof, you'd actually have to apply for planning permission for it? Did you know that? So that's the type of bureaucracy we have. Now, I'm sorry that we're in that type of situation. If a person's house burns down tonight and they're building the exact same house next month, they'll have to apply for planning permission
for it. But you are the minister. You could have drawn a line through that provision and said, no, we're not going to ask people to jump through that hoop.
No, you couldn't, because there has to be rules and regulations in a scheme. You just said it yourself. when you're dealing with public funds, you have to be accountable. You have to do it properly. If I didn't do it properly, you'd be having me on the radio saying that I didn't do it right. So, unfortunately, this is... If I didn't bring in the scheme, you'd be saying I was wrong not to bring in the scheme. So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. But at the end of the day, there's one very important thing, and you never asked me about this. Connor kept saying about the 1st of May, and of course the man is right. You're on a time frame here. It's the same as in the forestry sector. You're on a time frame because we don't want the value of the timber to deteriorate. We don't want a situation where the growers won't be able to propagate their seeds and put their seeds into the ground and grow. So yes, time is of the essence. And that is why I brought the scheme in as quickly as I can. Nobody could criticise the length of time it took for myself and my officials to introduce the scheme. We did it as
quickly. Just the amount of paperwork that's going to be involved in it. But look, I think the thing to do here, Minister, is 50 days from now, let's have you back again and let's find out where we're at and if the Conor Foxtons of this world have indeed met the window to get their seedlings into the ground, and if they haven't, what support you're going to be able to offer to them. Minister Michael Healy-Ray in our Radio na Gael Talk to Ballyvourna studios this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
You may not be the kind of person who pays too much attention to mart prices, but something very interesting that is going to have an impact on all of us is underway at the moment. The prices being paid for beef here have hit record levels, multiples of what they were a few years ago. Great news if you're in the business of beef production, not so much if you're in the habit of eating beef. And a large part of that price shift is because of a sharp fall in supply in the UK. Yesterday, I spoke to James Little from Harrison and Hetherington Mart in Carlisle in the north of England, just before he headed over here on a buying trip. He believes that the price paid for beef has passed through a threshold and it's not coming back down again.
I guess since the start of 2025, to coin a phrase, I suppose it's skyrocketed, hasn't it? Week on week, we see record highs, then it's a record for 7 days and we go again. It's, yeah, amazing, really.
Why is it happening?
Supply and demand. The cattle numbers dramatically reduced and have done over a significant period of time now. And I suppose we've got to, in some ways you would call it a perfect storm, in others you would call it a bit of a disaster, really, where there isn't enough cattle available to satisfy the demand.
What is it that has happened to reduce this supply?
Pretty simple, really. Over the last number of years, government policy, pricing structures, overheads have all led to farmers reducing their suckler herds. There's less cows across the UK. Now, yeah, we're at a point where we're not producing enough beef.
How many have you lost? Like, how many fewer cattle are you seeing going through your ring?
In our outlying markets in hill areas, and they solely rely on beef production from suckler herds. I would say in the last 2 to 3 years, we've probably seen it drop somewhere in the region of 20 to 25%. Carlisle on Saturday had a large sale of solely suckler bred beef calves, 12 months old. The number was 712 sold. Go back 20 years when I first started in here, it was a 2-day event with 1,000 bullocks and 1,000 heifers. So in 20 years, we're somewhere around 66% back, I would say.
Why do you think that the ground has shifted and that this is a permanent change in the price structure?
It shifted because the abattoirs are now looking at producers and it's got very, very competitive. They're all vying over vastly reduced number of cattle, which makes the price go one way, which is up.
What is happening here, James? Are the suckler farmers getting out of farming altogether, or are they just really reducing their numbers to a bare minimum?
I think it's a bit of both. The average age of farmers just goes up and up as years go by. Suckler farming is a dangerous industry, so there's a little bit of getting older. Have the cows been worth the hassle? Have they been paying the bills? Slowly and gradually, we have seen people coming out of the sucklers entirely or vastly reducing them.
Okay, but it does mean that if herds aren't being sold in their entirety, that guys could technically or theoretically build their numbers back up again
and bring that price back down? Or do you not think that that's likely?
I don't think it's likely. I can't see people having the capital to go out and purchase cattle at the prices they are. There's a few guys in here trying to buy bulling heifers on a Wednesday out the store market. They just can't handle the price. You know, the demand from the finishers round the ring, it far outweighs the demand from breeding herds.
James Little in Carlisle. I'm joined in studio by Ray Doyle from ICOS, the Irish Co-op's representative body. Ray would represent the livestock marts at a national level. Good morning, Ray. How are you? Price in this country is just kind of bumping underneath €8 a kilo. Give me a frame of reference for that. How much was it 2 years ago?
2 years ago, a little over €4 a kilo was the norm, plus bonuses in the meat factories. And at a live level, from the mart's point of view, we sell obviously cattle live. You know, €2 a kilo would have been a good price for most store cattle going into finishing units. Now it's €4 a kilo.
Okay, so doubled in that time. What component of that is the record prices being paid in the UK?
It's a significant component of it. Almost 50% of our beef that we produce in Ireland ends up in the UK, multiple shelves. And year on year, UK government policies has diminished UK farming. I was discussing this with UK farmers only this summer, and they have stewardship schemes in place that removes 20 to 25% of their productive land to wildflowers and biodiversity, etc. And that's all very laudable, but that's a direct hit on the production ability. In this particular farm, it's a large farm, 1,000 acres, 1,000 suckler cows. He had to sell 250 of those animals.
Farmers, anybody involved in food production is used to prices fluctuating, coming up and down. Would you share James Little's suspicion that the price has passed through a threshold now and isn't coming back down?
I would agree completely with James in that. One of our lecturers, when I studied ag science, made the comment that the beef cycle was one of the longest economic cycles of commodities that we had. It was decades long. So now, as James says, we have simply moved up onto a new threshold, and we're perhaps on this particular positive aspect of that particular economic cycle. Which
because
lasts.
Those who got out won't have the money to get back in short order. So we're not going to see a glut of animals in 2 or 3 years' time.
No, I wouldn't think so. Because at the moment, what's happening in the marts, yes, the record prices are there and they're excellent for people selling. They're coming back into the market again and they're replacing them with other animals, younger animals, because these animals now have jumped up in price as well. So they're remaining at the roulette table, for want of a better phrase.
Is this good news for the farmers who are still in beef production? Because very often, justifiably, you will hear farmers complain that they're not getting the price that is being charged in the supermarket. Are they getting this bonus?
Yes, they are. And that is the advantage of the livestock mart. They are truly getting the value when they put their animals in the livestock mart. We have seen over the last few weeks, let alone months, we have factory agents and buyers purchasing online, giving significantly more in pence per kilo for animals in the livestock auction ring than they are themselves directly at the factory gate. So in many ways, the farmers are being able to avail of the fact that the mart is in effect acting almost like a producer group and giving them the true value of the animals.
It's an ill wind that blows nobody some good, but I was thinking here as well about the local butchers. The supermarkets can mask any price increase in what they charge for other goods. Local butchers can't, can they?
No, the local butcher obviously is the first person that's now, I suppose, looking at the negative side of these high prices. But again, the cure for high prices is high prices. As James Little said earlier, we're on a new threshold. But there will come a point where it'll be an equilibrium will be reached, because again, if the prices keep going on this upward trajectory, demand will fall off. So at the moment, we don't know where this equilibrium will be, but it will be reached at some point.
The other tricky thing here might be that the climate emissions targets are based on an ever decreasing suckler herd. And with these kind of prices, do you think are we likely to start see more people producing more beef calves in Ireland, placing us under an even more challenging situation to meet those emissions targets?
Well, yes, I think the suckler herd will have stabilised this year as a direct result of these high prices, because
it had been declining.
It had been declining, and it has declined since 2012, since the milk quotas had disappeared. Because at the moment, we have 1.5 million dairy cows, 750,000 suckler cows. In 2012, we had 1 million of each. So this decline has been in train for well over a decade at this stage. Going back to your point on the on our climate change obligations, I'm sure there will plenty of innovative new solutions will actually emerge to deal with this. A little while ago, we had a major problem with poorly bred dairy calves. The advent and the widespread adoption of sex semen has more or less solved that problem. So I am confident in the science that we will actually come up with a solution that will mitigate our obligations.
Take a step back from all of this. Big picture, is this another signpost on the road to the end of the era of cheap food?
Yes. The cheap food is over. Because you've
it's in the rearview mirror
it's
already.
In the rearview mirror because, again, a point I made earlier, we were looking at figures of minus 1% of national herds all across Europe for the last 20 years. And it didn't seem much when you compared year one with year two. But you cumulatively add that up over the last 20 years, we have eroded our supply base. And our demand continues to grow, albeit slowly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It has been 0.5% every year. Why is it suddenly biting now? Why are we seeing these massive price increases in the space of 2 or 3 months?
Well, it's I suppose in economic in terms, there's only a 1% difference between a scarcity and a drought. And basically, that's what you're seeing now. This slow erosion has led to the point of we are now in trouble with supply. In conversations with some meat factory owners, they have said they have never seen it in 30-odd years where the customers are quite content to take an extra 10 cent a kilo rise next week as long as they get the product.
Ray Doyle from ICOS, thank you very much for joining us this morning. If your house is one of the 6,500 where there is someone sitting Ag Science for the Leaving Cert this year, you will no doubt be painfully aware that the projects, bold caps, letters, air quotes, exclamation mark, have to be submitted very shortly. Recently, we came across a school tour for Leaving Cert Ag Science students. It was in a farmyard in Offaly, and we asked Ronan Kelly to go along and see what was involved. He got there just as the buses with the students pulled up, sixth years about to submit their projects and fifth years looking for ideas for theirs.
I've never really been on a farm. Like, I live close to farms, but I've never really been on one.
Do you have a project?
No, we're actually looking today, I think, to look at a few ideas. Right. Haven't really thought of one yet.
Would you mind moving for me?
What I did is last summer I put trackers on sheep, and what I did is I gave them different feeds and I was seeing how much it affected their live weight gain.
Okay, and I do live on the farm?
I don't, but I live in Milltown and there's plenty of farms around me.
Well, we had a project last year and we had a student and he wanted to use cutaway bog because it was all around him and there was so much controversy around it, and he decided to plant blueberries on the cutaway bog. Himself and his grandmother did the project together and he wasn't farming either, and the project did really well. He was thrilled.
And tell me about projects. What do you think about projects?
I'm thinking about comparing a dribble bar and a splash plate on a slurry tank. See what works better.
You're going to have to say that for me again.
Yeah.
A dribble bar?
A dribble bar and a splash plate. Comparing them and see what grows better, grass.
All right, so yeah. A splash plate is where it...
Where it just throws it out and the dribble bar drops it close to the ground.
And how will you do that?
Just get fresh bit of grass and spread some of it slurry with the splash plate and spread some with a dribble bar and see what grows better.
You're all very welcome to Tullamore Farm. Very, very gentle around the sheds, no jumping in the pens, no shouting, just we want to be really, really calm when we're around livestock, and just follow your coordinators and teachers and the people on the staff.
Adam Woods, Deputy Editor with the Irish Farmers Journal. All the students will travel around the farm in groups of sort of 10 to 15 and they'll have a 10-minute talk basically on each sector.
Do you know what, when I googled it, the first thing that came up was, is Ag Science an easy honour?
Right, okay.
People are obviously ripping around looking for easy honours. Yeah, yeah.
It had that name, I think, in the past, but I think there's a lot more work to it now.
Several different things growing, but the main things what we have here is sphagnum moss. Sphagnum moss is very important for carbon capture, grows in waterlogged soils and peat soils, and as you can see here, there's layers and layers with broken down, and that is what's capturing carbon and capturing carbon in the soil.
Why do we cross black-faced mountain sheep with blue leasters? The mountain sheep tend to only have one lamb. They're very hardy, they're quite small, compact, very good mothers. Blue-faced leasters tend to have a lot of lambs. They're very prolific, 3, 4, maybe even 5 lambs. So by crossing the two, you get a medium prolificity ewe called a mule. She's quite good at turning grass into milk. She's got the hill genetics. She's quite hardy, very good mother, very maternal. So they fit into a lot of lowland sheep.
The synchronized breeding then, and then all the heifers they calve then all before the cows. That's the one that's in heat, the one that's jumping.
Are they not all girls?
Yeah, they're all yours in that pen, yeah.
I'm getting up and up to her.
Once they start coming in heat, that's when they show. that's how they show. Like Sean uses tail paint on them once they're being AA'd, and he'll put the tail paint on them every day, and once the tail paint's rubbed off every evening, he'll know that that one needs to be AA'd then.
What side did he go up on the tractor there? The left side. So the left side is where you enter the tractor. Does anyone know the reason?
Exactly. Too close.
All the controls are on the right. So if you enter from the right and you slip and fall, you could push a front loader down and then that could cause injury. So look, always enter from the left.
I have a Massey 65 that I done up from scratch. When I got it, it wasn't running. It was all seized. I just opened up the head pile in and then turned it around with a bar, and she unseized, thank God.
All right. And do you have somebody with you when you're doing it?
The father, yeah.
Okay. And he helps out?
A bit.
And what do you mean, a bit?
He does a bit.
Does he stand there telling you what to do, or does he?
Stand there looking.
Does he? Supervising.
Yeah, exactly.
So you'll be firing him fairly soon, I'd say, will you?
Yeah, she's already fired, so he is.
Is he?
They are always discussing buying spare parts because they're all parts are all secondhand on the tractors they work on and stuff.
And you're not getting them to shush up during class while you're trying to teach them if they're doing all this chat?
Well, we have an arrangement. I get loads of work out of them for the first maybe 40, and the last 5 or 10 minutes, they can do their wheeling and dealing the last 5 or 10 minutes. So what if they get their work done? So that's the way they operate.
Right. So you're running a little market inside the class.
Well,
take a cut, or does the school get a cut? No.
Well, no, we'll have to be discussing that further.
With the revenue.
All morning, the small groups of Leaving Cert Ag Science students are ushered from stand to stand by coordinators from AgriAware, like Emer Mannion.
I'm from Dublin, so I had no farming background. Fell into it in college, so I took ag science in college, hadn't done it before. It was difficult originally, but I think if you surround yourself with people who are willing to kind of answer your silly questions about it.
What was your worst silly question?
I think one of them was that I didn't realise that a cow had to be pregnant to produce milk. I think that was probably one of my most silly questions, which is amazing because I would have done well in school and everything, not a stupid person, but that's how disconnected I was from agriculture originally. So yeah, that probably would have been my first stupid question.
And do you remember what the reaction was?
I think there was a bit of laughing, but I think when I explained kind of my situation of like I'd never set foot on a farm, I only ever bought my milk in a shop, so there was no kind of thought around it, and a lot of my friends who are over 20 and even my parents wouldn't really understand the whole process, so I'm not alone in it, I guess.
Like Emer, most of the people I talked to in the farmyard found their way into agriculture by accident. For example, Nick, one of the sixth-year students from Maynooth Community College. He only ended up on a farm when he went looking for part-time work.
I was looking for more maintenance work, more like painting walls, fixing fences, not really going near animals. And then I kind of got just thrown in, and it was just unexpected, and now I love it.
Tell me what made it click for you.
I don't know, I think it's just the people I work with. Like, I'm the youngest down there. They all be 50 odd or 30 in and around.
That's so old.
I know. But I don't know, they're just, they kind of look after me, it's great crack, they love it.
Oh, do they? They're not slagging your...
Oh, well, every now and again, but sure, that's every farm.
back to the original question on Google for Nick and his classmate Thomas. Ag science for the Leaving Cert? Easy honour?
You'll do well.
I'd say if you put the work in, it'd be easy enough. And if you put the work into your project and you have a solid project and then put the work in with the theory, like it is, it's doable, you know, like it's not impossible.
Leaving Cert Ag Science students from Maynooth Community College and Kildare Town Community School there. The producer of this programme was going to do Ag Science Leaving Cert to see how hard it was, and then saw how much was involved in the project and said, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. That's all we have time for, folks. Enjoy your bank holiday weekend. Take care. Talk to you the same time next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.